This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, October 19th, 2007. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns. In today's program, protesters launched their campaign at the IMF and World Bank meetings in D.C. International criticism of the Burmese government's violent handling of protesters heightens. And the United States Africa Command draws criticism on and off the continent. All this and more, but first, these news headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with today's headlines. Twin bomb blasts in the Pakistani city of Karachi killed more than 130 people last night during a welcoming rally for former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto. Devon Terrior reports.
Benazir Bhutto's celebratory return to Pakistan after 8 years in self-imposed exile was shattered by two bomb blasts shortly after midnight as her caravan wound its way through the streets of Karachi, where over 200,000 of her supporters had met her arrival. Ms. Bhutto was on her way to the tomb of Pakistan's founder, Muhammad Jinnah, where she had planned to address her supporters. Bhutto had been warned of a possible attack, but she denied requests by the Pakistani government to shorten her route in the interests of security. 134 people are dead, including several journalists, and over 250 injured. In a press conference today, Bhutto joined other world leaders in condemning the attacks. No group has yet claimed responsibility. For FSRN, this is Devon Terrio Orr in Lahore, Pakistan.
The leaders of European Union member nations today agreed on language for a treaty to replace the bloc's defunct constitution. The rejection of the EU constitution by French and Dutch voters 2 years ago created a crisis within the EU governance structure. The new treaty will take effect in 2009 if ratified by all 27 member nations. The strike by City of Vancouver employees will likely come to an end this weekend after just under 3 months on the picket lines. Zach Badorf reports from British Columbia.
The Vancouver Public Library Workers Union has not yet signed the agreement, but a vote is expected today, bringing an end to the union's first strike in its 77-year history. The deal comes less than a week after the striking garbage collection workers successfully finished their negotiations with the city. They resumed services earlier this week, cleaning up months of trash piled up around the province's largest city. 78% of the library workers voted down a mediator's recommendations last week because they said it didn't fairly address pay equity amongst the mostly female staff. The tentative agreement they'll vote on today reportedly has only minor modifications to the original deal. But with now 87 days on the picket line, some of the workers are feeling the effects of the strike in their pocketbooks. Union representatives attended a nationwide union convention in Toronto Wednesday to ask for donations to sustain the workers in case they opt to continue their fight. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Zach Badorf in Vancouver.
As of New Year's Day 2008, it will be illegal for anyone in California to require a person to be implanted with a radio frequency identification chip in order to obtain a paycheck or government benefit. Kelly Ramirez has the story.
California becomes the third state, after Wisconsin and North Dakota, to ban forced human implantation. Civil penalties of monetary damages and injunctive relief are available to people who have been coerced or defrauded into accepting an implant. Nothing in the law forbids bonuses or other incentives to entice workers into being chipped. The new law is the first of a package of bills sponsored by Senator Joe Simidian of Palo Alto to pass the legislature. The others would place a 3-year moratorium on the use of RFID in driver's licenses and student ID cards and mandate security and privacy provisions in chipped ID documents required by state and local governments. Those bills will be taken up when the legislature reconvenes in January. For FSRN, I'm Kelia Ramirez.
The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals has agreed to reconsider a ruling that prohibited a ski resort in Arizona from using recycled wastewater to make snow on a mountain that is sacred to 13 Native American tribes in the southwestern United States. Christina Onestad reports.
Native groups said using treated sewage to make snow on sacred land devalued their spiritual practices. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeal agreed, but now the case is back in court. The Forest Service and Arizona Snow Bowl have argued the court ruling would allow anyone to challenge federal management of the government's own property if it caused, quote, spiritual disquiet, unquote. Howard Shanker is lead counsel for the Navajo Nation, four other Native tribes and environmental groups.
Here we've got a ski area in a place that doesn't get snow. It's on federal land, and our federal government thinks that supporting this privately run ski area on federal land outbalances the deeply held religious and cultural convictions of hundreds of thousands of Native Americans living in the southwestern United States.
Shanker expects the court to make a new ruling sometime next year. For FSRN, I'm Christina Onnestad.
And finally, a 16-month-long drought in the southeastern United States is threatening the supply of drinking water to the city of Atlanta. A project manager from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers said today that Atlanta has at least 100 days worth of easily accessible water, although other estimates predict that without rain, the city will run out of drinking water within 3 months. Those are today's headlines. I'm Shannon Young.
It has been more than 1 month since Buddhist monks first took the street in Burma, sparking large street protests aimed at toppling the Burmese military regime. In that time, Burmese security forces have reacted with brutal force, arresting nearly 3,000. And human rights groups contend that the Burmese government has engaged in the torture and killing of an untold number of people. Today, President Bush asked Congress to levy sanctions on Burma. He is also calling for the release of political prisoners.
We will continue to review our policies and consider additional measures if Burma's leaders do not end the brutal repression of their own people, whose only offense is the desire to live in freedom. Business as usual is unacceptable. So I applaud the efforts of the European Union and nations like Australia that have announced targeted sanctions on the Burmese regime. I commend nations such as Japan that have curtailed their assistance to Burma in response to the atrocities. I appreciate nations such as Singapore and the Philippines and Indonesia who have spoken out against the atrocities. I ask other countries to review their own laws and policies, especially Burma's closest neighbors, China, India, and others in the region.
Another country in the region is feeling pressure from critics of the Burmese government. Burma's detractors are requesting that South Korea demand more accountability for the brutal military crackdown. Large groups of Koreans have held daily demonstrations outside the Burmese embassy in Seoul, and evening candlelight vigils have been held on one of the busiest streets in the capital. Eunji Kang reports from Seoul.
Burma! Burma! Burma!
Free! Free!
Free! Free!
Burma! Free! Free Burma! Burma, Burma free. Dismantle junta, topple down Tan Shui.
지금 버마에서 일어나는 일이 우리 나라에서
I didn't know much about Burma before the recent demonstration, but I know one thing, that it is just like Gwangju uprising. So I believe we should help them.
시민을 상대로 한 학살은 어느 곳에서도 일어나면 안 된다고 생각하기 때문에
That was Taehee Kim, a high school teacher and Burma Solidarity Campaign activist. Like clockwork, she and other Burma Solidarity campaigners hit Seoul's busy streets, handing out petitions and shouting slogans to passersby about the recent Burmese crackdown on democracy activists. For Kim and many of her generation, the present situation in Burma brings back memories of the Korean government's suppression of a popular uprising in the city of Gwangju in 1980. According to official figures, government forces killed at least 200 people during this demonstration. Seung-hwan Baek is a lawyer who went through dark years fighting for democratic reforms under the former Korean military regime, including the killing at Gwangju. Baek explains.
When we were isolated inside Gwangju by the military government in 1980, the solidarity messages and campaigns from outside was the biggest power for us. Thanks to them, we were not alone and we were not forgotten. Without international solidarity, we were not able to build democracy in Korea. That's why we, Korean government and citizens, should not avoid the duty of a member of the world society.
In 1980,
the international community had been clear in their condemnation of the Korean military's suppression at Gwangju. And 7 years after the Gwangju uprising, in 1987, Koreans voted for a new government. crediting international support for helping years of democracy activism lead to a peaceful change in leadership. Cho Moo-hwa is the president of the Korean branch of the National League for Democracy, NLD. He escaped from Burma in 1994 and came to Korea to campaign for greater democracy in Burma.
In Burma, we knew about the democratization movement history of Korea. We knew about your ex-president Kim Dae-jung, the Nobel Peace Prize winner, and we heard of Kwon Ju uprising. So I thought I could actively work for Burma and Korea because the Korean people have a similar history and they would understand our struggle much more than any other people.
Public opinion polls suggest South Koreans are very sympathetic to the suffering experienced by the democracy movement in Burma. Jong Ho-shin is a high school student. Although he was born after Gwangju, Shin was still raised with the knowledge that Gwangju was a turning point for democracy in Korea.
It is not very long ago that we had no freedom or democracy either, just like the Burmese people. I heard my parents struggled a lot for democracy in the past. If there is any difference between Korea and Burma, it is that there were students leading demonstrations in Korea, but in Burma, Buddhist monks are leading.
Meanwhile, as public opinion is against the Burmese government's tactics, this has failed to sway the South Korean government from suspending diplomatic and economic ties with the Burmese government. South Korea has fostered close economic ties with the Burmese regime, based mostly on Burma's access to resources. As of yet, the South Korean government has made no public comment about the situation. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Eun-ji Kang in Seoul, Korea.
The nominee for U.S. Attorney General, Michael Mukasey, told the Senate Judiciary Committee that he could not rule out the use of interrogation methods such as waterboarding or simulated drowning. In this clip from Thursday's hearing, Democratic Senator Sheldon Whitehouse asked Mukasey about the method's constitutionality.
Just to finish that thought, so is waterboarding constitutional?
I don't know what's involved in the technique. If waterboarding is torture, torture is not constitutional.
If waterboarding is constitutional, is a massive hedge.
No, I said if it's torture. I'm sorry, I said if it's torture.
If it's torture, that's a massive hedge. I mean, it either is or it isn't. Do you have an opinion on whether waterboarding, which is the practice of putting somebody in a reclining position, strapping them down, putting cloth over their faces, and pouring water over the cloth to simulate the feeling of drowning, is that constitutional?
If it amounts to torture, it is not constitutional.
I'm very disappointed in that answer. I think it is purely semantic.
Sorry.
Mukasey also said the president, as commander-in-chief, may authorize a secret surveillance program. Despite this testimony, the former federal judge will likely be confirmed as the next U.S. Attorney General, replacing Alberto Gonzalez. As delegates to the International Monetary Fund and World Bank annual meetings converge in Washington, D.C., so do social activists. The October Coalition, which has representation from organizations working on healthcare, housing, and international trade and debt issues, has planned 4 days of actions to coincide with the meetings. The long weekend includes workshops, protests, and marches. Organizers want to raise awareness of social justice issues that are affected by IMF and World Bank policies. Catherine Jarmel has more from the protests in Washington, D.C.
IMF Managing Director Rodrigo de Rato this morning addressed topics such as oil prices, multilateral cooperation in handling global credit crisis, and the impact of the weakening dollar. He answered questions regarding Brazil's outspoken president, quota changes in IMF voting rights, and global warming, but he failed to address demonstrators with the October Coalition, who have converged in D.C. to protest the IMF policies this weekend. Their issues? Police brutality, immigration, displacement and gentrification, as well as international trade agreements. Basav Sev, an organizer for the coalition, explains.
We hope to convey that these institutions are illegitimate, that they exert a power over economies worldwide that is undemocratic and imperialist, that they impose policies on these countries without their consent, you know, without the consent of the people of these countries and without their approval, and policies that impoverish people throughout the global south, and their policies have immense social as well as environmental costs.
The coalition, which formed in June, is an ad hoc coalition made primarily of D.C.-based groups working for social justice and change. Marco Del Fuego spoke at this morning's rally in front of the Immigration and Customs Enforcement offices. Del Fuego explains the connection between immigration and the policies of the IMF.
A lot of the countries, they impose new liberal economic plans that each country has to adopt in order to pay their foreign debt, and countries have to cut the budgets for social programs, housing, healthcare, and basic rights. And small economies are taken over by big conglomerates. Small businesses, small farmers are put out of business. They can find jobs at the sweatshops because they are crowded. And people have no option but immigrating to this country and other wealthy countries in order to make a decent living. So it's this economic policy of these institutions that lead, that have a primary role. We only talk about the politics of this issue and the legal or illegal thing. But this is also a economic rights are also a key issue, and believe that this institution play a key role in maintaining this unjust economic order third world countries, and we wanted to denounce that and say that that must end.
As the meeting for the IMF wraps up Sunday, so will meetings for the October coalition. The IMF annual meeting hopes to bring together private and public sector leaders for dialogue and collaboration on world and economic development issues, as well as set the agenda for the IMF in the coming year. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Catherine Jarmel in Washington, D.C.
The first presidential primaries are only 3 months away, and maybe sooner if state jockeying over who goes first continues. In this week's political roundup, FSRN takes a look at some other political elbowing. Republican candidates are courting religious conservatives, and another presidential hopeful is looking more hopeless. He's dropped out of the race entirely. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell has more on this week's election news.
The Associated Press is reporting that GOP candidate Sam Brownback will once again be just a senator. At a news conference expected Friday in his home state of Kansas, he is likely to drop out of the crowded GOP race. Brownback's exit could help Governor Mike Huckabee, as they both were courting the same conservative Christian voters. Meanwhile, the Christian right will continue looking for an adequate candidate, while many in the Republican field are hoping to fill that role. They spoke at a conservative values conference hosted by the Family Research Council. Fred Thompson showed his family values by entering the stage with his wife and young daughter.
Of course, we must have good laws. We must do our best to stop bad laws. But we must also recognize the element of personal responsibility for every American in this country. And when we see local authorities giving birth control to 11 and 12-year-olds, we know that some values are seriously messed up in this country.
An honest John McCain admitted that he differs with conservative voters on several issues, including immigration. Choosing not to highlight those issues, he stuck to friendly topics such as abortion, federal spending, and the war.
I've spoken elsewhere at length about the strategy I propose. We need a larger military, real intelligence reform, increased contributions from our civilian agencies, and a commitment to victory in Iraq.
Meanwhile, the head of the Republican National Committee, Senator Mel Martinez of Florida, will step down. The organization in charge of election strategy is in a tough situation. 9 GOP members of the House and 5 senators have chosen to resign. As for the Democratic presidential candidates, Senator Chris Dodd has vowed to block a surveillance bill from moving forward because it would excuse telecom companies for illegally handing over customers' records to the government. In a forum on health care, Senator Hillary Clinton said undocumented immigrants will not receive the same level of health care under her health plan.
But as a general rule, people who are here illegally will not be eligible for the American Health Choices Plan. Legal immigrants, if they are children or pregnant women, will be. Because again, I think that people who are here legally deserve some better treatment and acceptance in the law than people who are not here legally.
Senator Barack Obama appeared on Jay Leno, where he was asked about what Liz Cheney said. that Obama and the vice president are related. They're eighth cousins.
The truth is, I am okay with it.
Yeah.
I don't want to be invited to the family hunting party.
And Senator Joe Biden told a Boston newspaper that he'll drop out of the race if he doesn't place fourth in the Iowa primary. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Immigrant groups from around the country are organizing a boycott of Western Union. 150 groups launched boycotts last month. They say workers transferring money to their families are being gouged by large fees and unfair exchange rates. This criticism is exacerbated by Western Union's poor track record of investing in immigrant communities. Today, they launched their campaign in Oakland, California. Eric Klein has more on the situation.
The boycott campaign against Western Union was launched last month in Los Angeles by TIGRA, Transnational Institute for Grassroots Research and Action. Since then, the campaign has spread across the country. Viviana Ranella works with TIGRA in Northern California. She says that immigrant groups from the Latino, Asian, and African communities joined them today to support the launch of the boycott in Oakland. Ranella says that Western Union is taking advantage of immigrant workers who are wiring money to their families.
This act of love has been transformed by financial institutions into a financial transaction.
Ranella says last year, immigrant communities around the globe transferred $260 billion worth of their earnings in remittances. That's money sent home to their families, which financial institutions like Western Union have profited mightily from.
We have focused on Western Union because Western Union is the undisputed giant of the industry. They command about 20% of the industry. They have over 300,000 outlets worldwide. That's 10 times more than McDonald's in the world. And they charge the highest fees. They have the most unfair exchange rates. And they invest very little in communities. They invest 41 cents out of every $100 that they profit.
TIGRA says it has been trying to negotiate with Western Union for over a year. They're asking for lowered fees and fair exchange rates. They're also asking Western Union to invest $1 from every transaction into a sustainable foreign development fund. And they want Western Union to stop investing its profits from remittances into projects and companies that are displacing people in other countries.
We have engaged with the company several times asking them to sign this community benefits agreement. Since they have not responded, we are launching this boycott.
Western Union did not return calls before deadline. TIGRA says that 189 organizations have joined the boycott against Western Union in cities nationwide. They plan to take the boycott global with a launch in the Philippines and Europe in the coming months. From Oakland, for Free Speech Radio News, I'm Eric Klein.
The United States Africa Command, or AFRICOM, which was set up to promote U.S. national security objectives in Africa, has now begun its operations from a military base in Germany. The command's headquarters will move to Africa next year. The Pentagon claims that the primary focus of AFRICOM will be humanitarian, but some say the command's goals are actually related to protecting U.S. oil interests there. Critics agree that AFRICOM will protect U.S. military and economic interests, but they also say the command will have negative consequences for the continent. Sam Olukoya reports from Lagos.
Officially, the stated objective of AFRICOM is to ensure Africa's development by making it a secure place. Tony Iyare is an expert on international relations.
By and large, the Americans say that they want a force, you know, some kind of stabilizing force in Africa, you know, and that's basically their interest, you know, and that means that they have to ensure that militarily, you know, Africa is secured. So that's just, you know, by the way, what the objective is, to try to stabilize, you know, Africa militarily.
Of the 53 countries in Africa, only a few like Liberia have offered to host AFRICOM's headquarters when it eventually moves to Africa. The Liberian president, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, told the BBC that her country supports the formation of AFRICOM because it will enable the United States to offer military training to African states. This, she says, will enable Africa to deal with armed conflicts within the continent.
You know, the AFRICOM has at its core a training element. If Africa will take the primary responsibility for intervention when there's conflict, then we need to have trained security forces that can intervene effectively. And we need the logistical support whenever they are called upon to intervene. I see AFRICOM as a mechanism that can provide those particular type of support for African intervention.
But critics say AFRICOM will do Africa more harm than good. Some say the key interest is to protect the economic interest of the United States, which is mainly oil, from the Gulf of Guinea. Many also believe the United States will use AFRICOM to exert its military authority in Africa, especially against Islamists. Sylvester Odion Akhene of the Lagos-based Center for Constitutionalism and Demilitarization says AFRICOM is part of an American plan to use its military might to impose its choice of leaders in African countries.
So the AFRICOM, for me, is going to, you know, impose its a reenactment of the Grand Area Plan, which the Americans implemented successfully in the Middle East. You know, of course, it has also boomeranged with the outbreak of the Iraqi war, you know, the American invasion of Iraq. The Grand Area Plan is simply about American control of the Middle East, you know, through the imposition of leaders that are amenable to American policies. You know, in the 21st century, it has a lot of implication for democracy. You are talking about having in place leaders that will be responsive, you know, and amenable to policies of the Americans, not leaders who will be responsible to their own people internally. It's a fundamental subversion of democracy.
Odion Ahene says Africa has to resist AFRICOM to avoid domination by the United States.
And this is a very frightening scenario. You know, nobody is speaking out against this monumental project of recolonization. You know, so it has serious implications, and I think that Nigerian should play a leading role in ensuring that AFRICOM does not become a reality.
There are fears that with AFRICOM, Africa may become the victim of another Cold War, this time between the United States and China, which is also trying to increase oil supplies from Africa. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Sam Olukoya in Lagos.
Violence has claimed the life of a South African reggae star. Yesterday, gunmen shot and killed Lucky Philip Dube in an apparent carjacking attempt in a Johannesburg suburb. Three men are suspected in the shooting. Dube was 43. Police say Dube was dropping off his son when the attack took place. His daughter was also in the car at the time of the murder. She was not physically injured. The singer, lauded for popularizing reggae in South Africa, rose to international stardom in the 1980s when he changed from singing traditional Zulu or Umbakonga music to the Jamaican-born reggae sound. His first reggae album, Rastas Never Die, was banned by South Africa's apartheid government in 1985, but his work continued to cover political themes that included racism, justice, and poverty issues.
Too many people hate apartheid. Why do you like it?
The murder of the reggae icon shocked mourners in South Africa, who say his death reflects the nation's spiraling crime rate. South Africa has one of the world's highest murder rates, with as many as 50 homicides a day. There were 20,000 killings reported in 2006 alone. You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.